just wanted to make sure everyone knows the difference between a router and a switch and a hub, because you're in networking class, so you should know this stuff. When you go to Fry's, otherwise you'd be like the electrical engineer and not know how to close the doors or something like that. So routers are network layer devices, so they inspect the IP datagram, as you guys all know from this last lab. They decrement the TTL with the PPID checksum, and then they port it on to the next hop. So they are actually opening up the Ethernet layer frame and then inspecting and modifying the IP header. So they're network layer devices. But switches and hubs are link layer devices. So they don't modify the IP datagram at all. In fact, they only open up the payload of the Ethernet frame. And you can have a Ethernet hub or switch in your network topology, and you can't actually tell that it's there, generally speaking, from just these standard network tools that we've been talking about, like ping, trace route, and so forth. So they're transparent to the network. So let's just go through a hub. A hub is just pretty much the simplest link layer device we think of. It's just a repeater. So remember, we've been talking about all this like CSMA, CD type thing with Ethernet as if it was shared, like a single Ethernet coax shared between multiple nodes on the same wire. And so this is one way to do it, at least in the early days of Ethernet, where you just have one wire shared by multiple, like literally one physical wire shared by multiple nodes. But nowadays, where you usually see the logical equivalent of this is where you have a hub. And so basically a hub, so here's a single hub, it's connected to a bunch of nodes. And the idea is when I send a packet from a node, when I send an Ethernet frame from one node into the hub just does this dumb thing and just electrically repeats the packet onto all the other Ethernet links here. So even though each Ethernet wire is only connected to two things, so each Ethernet wire is connected to the hub and one of the nodes in this simple case, effectively all these nodes are on the same collision domain. So in other words, since the hub is just electrically repeating the frame from one node to every other node, if there's a collision, it gets heard by all the nodes here. So there's no store and forward characteristic to the hub. So it can be fast because it just literally just copies the frame without any buffering onto all the other output links. But the problem is, as I said, all the ports aren't a single collision domain. And so, does this sort of make sense? So the hub doesn't actually make a decision as to which output port it should go to. It just copies to every single output port without waiting.
Are hubs a lot cheaper than a router? Are they a lot like cheaper? Like, are these kind of like...
They're cheaper. I don't know.
Yeah, they're cheaper. Everything is so cheap now.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But yeah, you can go to Fry's and buy a hub and it'll be slightly cheaper than a switch, which we'll see has a little more intelligence. Because it doesn't copy the frame to every single output port.
Hubs just because you couldn't have too long Ethernet wires, or what was the reason?
Well, the hubs actually don't solve that too long problem. So let's actually just go on to the next question here. Or then there's like two questions. So let's say you have a 10-port hub that's connected to 10 hosts using gigabit links. So imagine there's 10 hosts here and each of these links is a gigabit. So what's the maximum aggregate transfer rate of data flowing through this network? So if I take every single link in this network, what's the maximum throughput through all those links?
Only one person can talk at a time, right?
Yeah.
So just 1 gigabit per second?
Yeah, only 1 gigabit per second can be flowing, because basically only one of these links can be active at a time, because they're all in the same collision domain. And clearly that's bad, because if you intuitively think about it, you might think, okay, I've drawn a circle around 10 links, each a gigabit per second each. So I probably should get 10 gigabits per second of cross-sectional bandwidth. But actually, I get 1 gigabit per second because only one guy can talk at a time. Because if this node is transmitting, then it gets repeated to all the other nodes, so they can't be talking at the same time, just because of the CSMA collision detect and avoidance algorithm that Ethernet uses. Does everyone see that? Okay, so here's the second question about hubs. So 100 megabit per second Ethernet restricts cable length to 100 meters because there is a physical limit on the length of an Ethernet cable because you need to be able to detect collisions. That was from the last review session last Thursday in class, or last Wednesday in class. So suppose you want to connect two hosts that are 1 kilometer apart. Can you use 100 meter cables with 9 hubs in series to accomplish this?
No, because even though the signal won't be attenuated by the distance, but like the collision timing will still be affected because it'll take the same amount of time to keep the hubs in the middle to get down that 1 kilometer.
Right. So remember, the hub is just doing the stupid thing. It's not doing any termination or like storing of the frame before it propagates it through the output port. It just literally just sends it to the output port. So every single link on these 10 links that are 1 kilometer long are in the same collision domain. And that actually doesn't work because 100 megabits per second Ethernet restricts the cable length to 100 meters. So you can't do this. You can't string hubs together and try to like try to increase the longest length in your network. You have to use a switch. So all the ports on the same domain, transp is the amount of time it takes to transfer the minimum size frame, and prop is the amount of time to get that length. So you remember that there's this constraint. And the standard actually limits the number of hubs you can use in series and specifies that maximum network diameter. So any questions about hubs? All right, so now let's talk about switches. Switches are slightly more intelligent, and they're actually storing forward devices. So they terminate the collision domain. So the idea is, if this is a switch, and this node sends a frame to the switch will examine the destination MAC address of the frame. And if that destination MAC address is in its MAC address to the port table, then it'll just send that frame along that with a single link to that destination MAC address. So in the ideal case, a frame comes in, and the switch just knows which output port to send it along. So instead of copying to every single output port, it copies it only to one output port. And the other thing that switches do is, because they have to look at the destination MAC address, so they're stored forward devices because they have to wait for the Ethernet frame to come in anyway to look at that destination MAC address. So they terminate the collision domain. So in other words, once a frame gets sent from a node into the switch buffers the frame, and then it takes care of the collision detect and collision avoidance of sending it to the destination node. So that's why a switch can terminate the collision domain. So in other words, this node can be sending frames along at the same time as this node is sending frames onto the switch, because the switch is buffering the frames that have to be resent using this collision detect, the collision avoidance algorithm. And the way it builds up this MAC port table is just a simple learning algorithm. So if I have seen a frame from you before. So suppose this node has MAC address X, and it's on port 1. So the first time I get a frame from you, from MAC X on port 1, it just adds to the MAC to port table. It adds MAC address X to port 1. And then this is how it figures out how the MACs and ports are mapped together. So it's just a simple learning algorithm. And if it can't find the MAC address in the MAC to port mapping table, it does the same thing as a club. It just copies it to all the output ports. So you can use a switch, because it terminates the collision domain, to increase the network diameter. Any questions? Okay, just a couple more things, because to go over some of the stuff that we talked about on Tuesday, about the OS and hardware interface. So there are a couple of ways that you can communicate with the hardware. So remember, what it looks like is something like you have a CPU, sort of as a bus or some interface to the memory, and the memory also has some interface to the hardware, at least in the most high performance hardware. And there's also probably some bus that links. So one way that you can send a command to the hardware is through these memory mapped addresses. So in the operating system, instead of mapping a particular address to actually someplace in memory, that particular address is actually mapped to some hardware register. So you can ask the hardware to, like, you know, wake up or something like that, just by storing a command to that location. And you can get data from the hardware registers just by reading from a memory map addresses. So in other words, when you load up these addresses or dereference and store to these addresses, they're not actually going to memory, they're actually at the hardware, like that network interface card. Okay, can anyone think of, like, some drawbacks to this approach of interfacing the hardware? Yeah.
The I/O bus is really slow, right? So
yeah.
The memory, the hardware, like writing to the hardware registers, it's going to take a lot longer than writing to memory, and
right.
The CPU is going to have to block on the memory, right?
Yeah. So the CPU, you basically have to block when you do a store to the hardware device register, which could take a long time, and basically your CPU is just waiting around for that store operation to end. So it goes a lot slower than a normal store operation. So basically, you're just blocking your CPU on I/O devices. And I/O devices are usually slower than your CPU, so that's bad. So instead, another way to get stuff from the hardware, like your network interface card, which wants to get a packet to the CPU, is by using direct memory access. And so in this case, you hook up the hardware to the memory through some bus usually, and the hardware can actually directly write to your physical memory. And this usually happens, the CPU sends some POE command to the hardware, so that can, like, you know, so the hardware can start writing to some known place in the physical memory. And that just kicks off the writing to the memory, and the CPU can go on and do something else. And at some other point, the CPU can check the memory for the data that it was waiting on from the hardware, like the network packet. Okay. Usually the hardware will wake up the CPU and let it know it's done through something and interrupt. So this is a lot better because you can overlap the computation on the CPU with the hardware actually moving stuff to the memory instead of constantly pulling instead of constantly reading from the hardware through the memory map register, one word at a time.
Are you saving pages in memory for the hardware then? Like, when you do this? Like,
yeah, so the CPU, the operating system has to make sure that, you know, you're not just writing over some physical memory that you need.
Okay.
So you might have to back out the memory to disk. But that's for the OS to figure out. But conceptually, all you're doing is you're just giving the hardware some direct access to the memory, and they can just write, like, packets to the memory, and you can just inspect the memory later on, either through polling or through interrupts. So is everyone familiar with interrupts, CPUs? So basically, a CPU is running along with some execution context, like it's doing some loads and stores and adds or whatever your current program is that's loaded. And then at some point, there's some interrupt lines, like some physical interrupt pins on the CPU that allow external devices to tell the CPU to stop executing the current instruction sequence. And instead, it jumps to an interrupt handler. So whatever the CPU is doing just stops doing it. It saves it somewhere, like on the stack. And then it jumps to an interrupt handler that will service the interrupt caused by the hardware. So this allows you to do something. This allows you to stop the CPU from doing whatever it's doing to service the hardware device that caused the interrupt. I don't know how much this will help you to know for the final, but was the I guess it kind of helps if you take it with OAP or CS140, but yeah, the basic idea is you're executing some instructions, and there's some execution context, like all your device registers and your current instruction pointer, your current stack pointer, all those things get saved off the stack when an interrupt gets asserted, and then you jump to some known location in memory that has an interrupt handler, and that's usually like written in your OS kernel somewhere. And an interrupt handler figures out what device caused the interrupt and then does some servicing of the interrupt to make it go away and then jumps back to whatever code was executing before. But anyway, this is just to give you a general idea of what DMA versus memory mapped registers. Yeah.
So does the interrupt precipitate context switch?
Yeah, generally, because you're in user mode here, so you can't do any privileged instructions here, generally. Like, you're in the middle of executing your whatever application, like Microsoft Word, and it's doing all these instructions, and then all of a sudden an interrupt comes along to see, and that stops that makes the CPU save the context of the current instruction stream, like where it is, like the current instruction pointer. And all the stack, current stack, and all the CPU registers, it makes it save it out to some place that we can see it later, and then it jumps to the interrupt handler inside the OS. So it's like hard-coded in your CPU to do this. Like when this line gets asserted, it will jump to that place in memory that has the code to service the interrupt. That's like the basic idea of how these interrupts work. Okay, just one more quick thing about polling versus interrupts. So polling is just what it sounds like every second or every millisecond or every X number of seconds, check the device to see if there's something to do with the device, like check this piece of memory to see if the packet is arrived yet. So that's efficient if there's lots of data to process. And not so efficient if there's not a lot of data process, because a little piece of data comes in and you have to wait until the next polling interval before you actually process that data. Whereas in an interrupt, you literally just have the device stop your current execution to service whatever piece of data just came in. So the latency is lower, but the big problem that David was talking about in class on Tuesday or on Monday is that this can lead to live lock. So basically, you get so many interrupts that you can never make forward progress. This is different than a deadlock, because deadlock means you just totally stop. You can't get out of the deadlock because you have this recursive like lock waiting thing happening. In this case, like if you just pulled the network cable out of the network interface card, the interrupts would stop, and eventually you would process all those interrupts like in batch and row. But because interrupts take a finite amount of time to service, at some point, if you have too many interrupts, your CPU just can't keep up. So it just continually just gets interrupted, and you'll never finish servicing any packets. And the whole network dies, or your whole network interface card dies. So what David was saying is there's this paper which says that you should use like hybrid, like sometimes use polling, sometimes use interrupts based on the current situation. I don't know, it might come up. Questions?
Okay, so we'll talk about wireless next week.
Bill's going to do two more lectures.
Yeah. Okay, so Lab 5, it's in Java, which might be less good than you think it is. Because you basically have to do all the same things you would do in C, right? You have to look up some object or even function that does like applies to MS or something. So
yeah. Don't tell David.
Oh yeah. So you have to implement a distance vector routing protocol, which is RP, like a subset of RP version 2. And it basically is what we talked about in the section a few weeks ago. And what you saw a little bit on your midterm exam. So you have to exchange routing tables with your neighbors. If you find a better, lower cost route to a destination through your neighbor, then update your cost to that destination and use that neighbor as the next stop to that destination. So some references you can use the assignment web page. Textbook has a section on distance vector and a section on RIP. We'll give you an overview, patient meter pressure. And you can always look at RC if you really want exhaustive detail, but you don't have to implement all the features. So you only have to implement the stuff on the site. Okay, so let's just do a refresher on RIM. So remember, it's a distributed algorithm. All you do is exchange your routing table with your neighbors. And like I said, you find a better cost path for your neighbors, update the cost to the next hop. So let's take a look at the code again so people can see this. So distance of x to y, that's your local routing table, it's cost from x to y. Or if you are node x, then this is your local routing table, it's cost from x to y. And cost x comma y, that's the edge cost of a link from x from node x to node y. So these are just three routers. Here's a couple nodes that aren't routers. And the idea is, if you get a new routing table update from your neighbor, and you take a look at every single entry in this routing table, so this entry has a next hop. Well, actually, it doesn't have to have a next hop because you're getting it from the perspective next hop. But the entry has the cost to destination, and it has the it's just the cost of destination, and you know what the next hop is. The next hop in this case is C, and so you look up in your local routing table the cost to get to this destination for this entry, and that's D of DV. That's entry.cur cost in this pseudo code. So in other words, I'm going to look up in my routing table the entry, routing table entry that corresponds to getting to the destination. And that has a certain cost. So if the cost of getting to that destination is greater than the cost to get to the neighbor, or myself to the neighbor, plus the cost to get from the neighbor to the destination, then I update the cost. And the other caveat here is also the next hop in the routing table is your neighbor, then you always have to update it no matter what. Because otherwise, basically, if you don't have this for entry.next hop is B, you'll never be able to get your routing, you won't be able to get your route cost to increase. Because otherwise, you only have this less than or equal to thing to update cost. So you never be able to increase cost. So this is in case like, neighbor increases the cost of a link, then you have to increase the cost of a link in your local table as well. And if you update any entries in your routing table, then you send your routing table to all your neighbors. So that's a basic algorithm that you have to implement. Of course, it's a lot. There are a lot more edge cases than this. And also, you have to update, handle the update in case a local link has changed. Like, if I change the price of this link from 1 to like 5 or something, then I have to rerun this algorithm. And also, if the link goes down, I'm going to have to take that link out of the local routing table and run the algorithm again. So, basically, three types of updates that trigger a the algorithm to run. Anyone have any questions? Okay, so the way the code works basically is every time an RIP packet comes in, this accept packet function gets called, and all the tasks are done for you. So that eventually, through this raw IP packet, you get some class called RIP routing update, which was created out of that raw IP packet. And then you can call some object-oriented functions like get array list, like get all entries gives you an array list of routing table entries. And then you can look in the RIP routing table entry. That's another object that you can do to get the next, that you can query to get the cost to any of the destination networks. And then you can get the cost to the neighbor through this get local link info for next hop. So the idea is you got a packet with the source address of C here. So C is going to be the next hop. So you pass it into get local link info for next hop. The IP address is C. And then it gives you a data structure that is called local link info. That gives you the cost of this link to C, and you know, some other, like the interface that it's on, and so forth. So a lot of this assignment, you'll have to kind of sort of figure out the program framework, because it's object-oriented rather than the C stuff we've been doing all quarter. And if you want to send a packet, like send the routing table update, then you call mports port update out that push out. Packet is of type IP packet, and then you build up this IP packet by creating a new routing table update. And the routing table update, there's a method that lets you get an IP packet from it, so that you send. So you build up the routing table update by calling the add entry method on it, and adding routing table entries from your local routing table, which is also another, it's another instance variable inside your the object that you're given. And then you just call this push out and send it to the packet for notify alarm, the code gets called periodically, and you should use it to do periodic housekeeping. Like, there's a TTL field that I haven't mentioned in these routes. These dynamic routes have a TTL field. I think it gets initialized in 20. So when it gets decremented down to 0, then you have to remove the dynamic route. And if you remove the route from your local routing table, you have to send out your routing table again, because that route has disappeared. You're going to have to sort of get familiar with the Java function for manipulating IPs and applying NS and other miscellaneous tasks like that. So net utils that apply NS, INET address, net class, you'll have to use in this assignment. And those are just documented in the SUD Java docs. They're just part of the standard Java library. And then for references and all these things that I've been talking about here, you should check out the CLAC Java doc. So the CLAC is the name of the network simulator that you're programming against for this assignment. Okay. All your code is just going to end up with one rfproutingjava file, maybe like 350 or 400 lines of Java. And all the methods that you have to call that use the CLAC that are against this network simulator should be in the CLAC Java. So unlike your last, routing, unlike this assignment lab 4, where you're actually manipulating real packets that get sent from real web clients, this is just inside a Java network simulator, and it's just running locally on your machine. So you want to make this topology business to worry about or any of this. You don't have like to like manually get the like network log dump or anything. So it's all in Java. There's even like a built-in like sort of less sophisticated version of Ethereal that lets you get a virtual packet dump. Like you can just like double click on a router. I mean, I can demonstrate it, but you like double click on a router, click the Ethereal button, and boom, you see like a log of packets that are coming in real time in the network simulator. And so it's kind of interesting actually. But this also means to generate traffic, you have to use this Plax shell. So you have to like double click on a router, open a shell, and type pin to another virtual IP, the virtual topology that's running on the machine. I'll go over, I'll run it. Hopefully it works. But these are some of the basic methods and functions you'll have to get used to using in this assignment. So there's all the devils in the details, not just that 10 lines of code that I showed you before. So there's some additional edge cases you have to worry about. For example, what happens if someone gives you a routing table update and there's a new entry that's there that's not in your current routing table? Then you've got to basically add that entry to your current routing table. That inside loop that I showed here for each, in this loop here where I said look up routing table destination, so this is looking up the routing table entry, your local routing table entry that corresponds to this destination you just got, that's going to give you a null back. So you just add it to your local routing table. So that's what happens when the new network's advertised. What happens if you get, so for example, you know that this link is down, and you know that this link's network mask is, I don't know what it is, 1.3/31 or something. So suppose you know that this link is down since it's your link. And then you get a routing table update that says, oh, I know how to get to this interface. That's your interface, like our interface. Then you should ignore it. You should ignore it because basically A thinks he has a way to get to your interface, and it's telling you that erroneously through a routing table update. But you already know that you can't get to that interface, so because you own that interface on your own router. So if you don't watch out, you can basically end up creating routes like you would create a route to A to back to yourself, but even though that interface on your own router is disabled. So you'll think there's a way to get to an interface that's disabled on your router if you don't watch it. You'll have to, like I said before, handle the case of what happens when the local link metric, like local link cost, or the local link has gone down. And split horizon with poison reverse. So remember, this basically means that in my routing table, I'm getting to a destination through C, then I should advertise to C the cost of getting to that destination is infinite, which is some constant, like 16 or 200 or something, fine. It's like a final constant in that class that you're given. So you can't just, when you send out the routing table update, you can't just blindly just copy your routing table to the neighbor. You actually have to modify it, depending on whether you got that, learned that route from the neighbor or not. So there's all these little catches, fortunately. But it should be an interesting assignment, I think. Well, there's less code, but it could be harder to debug since this would be other. So, any questions?
I could just try a quick demo. So, so if you download the starter files from the class, you'll see all these topologies, and you can load up the reference topology, and that just loads up the solution code, and except it doesn't work. It's too bad. Oh, I see. So there's a typo on the web page. I'll fix that. So here's what happens when you start it off. So you can see you're giving a topology. This is just a virtual topology running on your local computer. And you can see turns out there's a couple more routers on that side, but there's 5 routers, 2 hosts here. And then you can switch to routing table view to see what the distance vectors are. So now you can see that it's actually dynamically computing the routing table. And you can see the time to live is decrementing periodically. When it gets to 0, it gets removed. So for example, let's say you want to take out this link. You can double-click the link, and you'll start seeing routes get disabled, all the routes that went through that link. It's going to learn new links. And if I start disabling more routes, you can see that if I start disabling all the routes, then eventually the RIP algorithm detects that there's no way to get to any place. Eventually, all the routes will go away. So you can play with this a bit. This is a reference code. You can play with it. It's like JavaScript. So hopefully but anyway, you get a reference class to play with, a reference solution to play with, like this. And maybe you want to turn everything back on so we can actually see what's going on. So. Yeah, the ones that are not on are red. So, like I said, this is not actually routing real packets. It's routing virtual packets inside this application. So you can't use Firefox like in this last assignment we had. So suppose I want to get to 171.64.2.10. So I would open. Actually, let's just do something quickly. So ethereal. Okay, so I basically open a packet dump on this host, and I'm going to open a CLACK shell on router 1, and I'm going to ping. And what you actually see here is you can see the route that the packets are taking inside this virtual node. So you can see that the Ethernet's getting stripped, level 2 demux. So if you look at this, it's basically like a flow diagram. It's all handled here for you. I mean, all this code's given to you. And if you look at the ethereal packet dump, you basically can see in real time the pings that are coming into this virtual node. So there's a lot of stuff to play with in case if things go wrong. And you can zoom out to get back to the regular CLACK thing. So there's some videos on the CLACK router webpage that you can probably take a look at, or at least the initial CLACK tutorial, so you can get an idea of how to use this software to test your router. That gives you an idea of some of the things you can do in CLACK. Just to give you an idea of what's going on. So if you zoom into this, one of these routers, what happens is you're getting all these components are given to you, like all the components that are needed for a functioning router, except for this thing, RIP routing router. So that's the block you have to complete. So basically, every time it gets a level 3 packet, it checks to see if it's an RIP update packet, and it passes it to your class. And your class can then send an update to the IP route lookup file, and that'll update the routes.
look at all this stuff that's given to you. You just have to do that.
The protocol is RIP.
It's over UDP. Yeah. So basically, it looks at the UDP packet and sees it's the RIP port. And if it is, then it gets passed to you.
So are those the only types of, I guess, level 3 packets besides ICMPs that a router handles?
Well, at least for this router.
Okay.
Yeah. Right, because you can see it's only ICMP debugs and this RIP routing. Things are the only thing that this router that's given to you commands. So, should give you an idea of sort of how to start. I'll go over more next week. So, if you're done with lab 4, you will.